Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table today. Bit of a special episode, this one, which is part of the concept of the Angus Table, is when we get significant information to the Angus breed that we're able to use this as an information mechanism for the benefit of Angus breeders, both commercial and seed stock. This afternoon, we're joined by Ben Robinson, and Ben heads up a program at AusMeat, which is in the news a bit this week. Welcome, Ben, to the podcast.
Thank you, Scott. Great to be here with you guys this afternoon.
We've invited Ben along. You will have seen in the media over the last few days, and by the time this episode comes out to the listeners, there's been some chatter about the Angus breed content that's put on beef labels in the marketplace. And this has been a chatter that's been going on over the last couple of years, really. And sometimes there's been articles in Beef Central and other places of note, but we thought it was good to go back to the source and introduce Ben. Ben will explain what his role is, what is AusMeat, what do they regulate, and how do they operate in the industry, and then we'll dive into what does these changes to the Angus breed content mean for the industry. So first of all, Ben, what's your role? What do you do at AusMeat?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Yeah, look, I'm the general manager of the meat standards and training programs at AusMeat. So, look, that's my primary role, and that encompasses all things with regard to trade description and the way that you describe your meat products when those products are exported out of Australia. So that's my primary role. Look, I hold another position with the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe as chairman of meat standards group as well. So that enables me to have a bit of a global oversight, if you like, of trade description standards around the world. So a lot of that work involves collaborating with all the other exporting countries and in particular the US very closely, in fact. So
it's interesting. I always learn something on these podcasts. Ben, I didn't realise you sat on that role with the United Nations. So congratulations. That's quite a significant role. Ben, what is AusMeat? How do they fit into the world?
Yeah, look, AusMeat's always flown under the radar, Scott. You cannot export meat out of Australia unless it comes out of an AusMeat accredited export processing facility. So we kind of tick away where the rubber hits the road, right? So our primary role and reason for existence is that we're responsible and the custodians of what we call the AusMeat National Accreditation Standards. And they're a set of standards that industry have to implement for the red meat industry if they want to export. And what that means is that within those standards, that outlines all of the trade description requirements, right? So the trade description requirements are all the elements that you see on a box of beef that describe what is in the box. And ultimately, that is has a big indicator on the ultimate sale and price per kilo of all the meat products that leave Australian shores. So for us, the partnership that we have with the Commonwealth Government, AusMeat are the custodians of the standards, and we're responsible for making sure that Australian exporters comply with those standards.
Ben, is AusMeat a government department? Is it a statutory body that sits aside?
Yeah, so AusMeat's an industry body. So we're owned by Meat and Livestock Australia and the Australian Meat Processing Corporation. And the beauty of our business, we're a not-for-profit organisation. And the beauty of our business is that we're here for industry. We're owned by producers and processors. And as the third-party certification body, if you like, we are the truly impartial body that kind of sits in the middle between the supply chain. And we facilitate all of the, the market access requirements. They're imposed on our Australian exporters. And we're the ones that are conducting the audits, the verification of systems, if you like. And that's what gives our Australian exporters the ability to access the pretty close to 100 different markets that we access around the globe.
And is it mandatory for exporters to be involved with AusMeat?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So if you're going to export beef, sheep or goat, and it's actually voluntary for pork. But if you're exporting beef, sheep or goat, then you have to be Ausmed accredited, and that's part of the underpinning criteria for a processing facility to get their export license with the Commonwealth.
Excellent. And Ben, how does it relate to the domestic market? So we understand that from an export point of view. Do you have a role domestically?
Yeah, look, it's a voluntary program, the Ausmeat program, Scott, for domestic processors. So having said that, we do have a number of domestic processors that that are Ausmeat accredited. And look, the main purpose of that is it enables those smaller processing sheds, if you like, to be able to compete at the same level as the export processors. And more often than not, what they're doing it for is for the discipline. It's a discipline that, and things that they can put in place that enables them to trade at the same level as an export processor would.
What are some of the other aspects that you get involved with at Ausmeat? Not so much your side, but how broad is the organisation?
Yeah, look, I mean, the meat side of our business is a percentage of the business. We work right across the agricultural supply chain. So in total, Ausmeat audits probably in the vicinity of 60-plus different quality assurance programs across both the livestock, the meat and the horticultural industries. So again, we perform that same sort of function. So where market requires standards programs, integrity programs, and Ausmeat's there as a third party certifier, and the ultimate goal is market access, right? So if you're a fruit and veg grower supplying products into Woolworths, there's some mandatory requirements that have to be met. Ausmeat can provide those audit services, and that those services ultimately give you the ability to access that market. So like I said, in excess of about 60 different programs that cover the entirety of the supply chain, right through from production and growers through to yard facilities, livestock exchange, meat processing facilities, right across the gambit of things like animal welfare, food safety, right through to our trade description requirements that we're here to talk about today, and then even to the extent where we're auditing butcher shops and the like for food safety requirements. So we're pretty much taking care of the whole supply chain and all the market access requirements that exist across the fairly diverse set of markets and industries that we've got.
The broad footprint. Ben, what sort of team do you have at what sort of staff numbers do you have at Ausmeat to achieve those goals?
Yeah, look, we've got there's roughly 100 employees at Ausmeat. We have access to a group of contractors as well that are out on the ground, but we have at the moment about 43 permanent staff that are auditors, and those guys are situated right across Australia, very strategically, of course, because you know we're going to the furthest corners of the country, both on the main island and Tasmania, and we actually also have three auditors in New Zealand. So, and again, they're performing the same functions in New Zealand, and their market access programs for the New Zealand market to access the different export markets that they have as well. So our footprint, is through Australia and New Zealand primarily.
That's significant. A lot of our producers, obviously, are supplying product with 4,000 members, and it'll be nearly 100% of those producers producing cattle. Angus cattle that go into a plant where you'll have a footprint or an influence. So it's probably one of those parts of the industry that our members interact with indirectly, but never directly. So it's a good conversation to have with you this afternoon and get a better understanding.
Yeah. And just to add to that, Scott, as well, look, we're interacting with the producer sector all the time. So if your listeners have had an LPA audit before, if your listeners own a feedlot and a part of the National Feedlot Accreditation Scheme, then all of those auditors are full-time or contract auditors for Ausmeat. Yeah. So, like I said, our reach is far and wide. You know, we do in excess of 4,500 LPA audits a year. There's a fairly significant number of feedlot audits as well. So like I said, the reach is far and wide.
Excellent. Well, first of all, just to go back slowly, become general manager of a division of Ausmeat. What's your background? You've worked in the industry for a long time, haven't you?
Yeah. So, hey, look, I'm from a livestock background. That's where I grew up, in a small country town called Gloucester in New South Wales, just a little bit down the hill from you, I think, there in Armidale, Scott. And yeah. I was very fortunate enough to in the very early years of leaving school to get myself a job with Meat and Livestock Australia and work on the very foundations of the MSA grading program. So I spent the best part of 8 to 9 years working on, like I said, the foundation of the grading program. I was an independent grader at the time, as it was, and I was lucky enough to travel the country and grade product. I was involved in the quality assurance teams. I was involved in training the supply chain for a whole bunch of different things that might relate to eating quality. And primarily, I spent a lot of my time working in processing facilities. And all of that was off on the back of making sure that we maintain the integrity and we give that the MSA grading program a good platform for the future, which was, and that started right back in the late 90s. So that's kind of a foundation. And I've been here at Ausmeat now since 2008. So that's probably getting on for about 16 to 18 years. It's a long time when you think about it. And like most of us here at Ausmeat, we start in auditor-type roles. I was lucky enough to work my way through the training department and manage our training team here. And back in about 2020, took on the general manager's role of all of our meat standards programs. So, I'd like to think I'm fairly technically minded, probably too much for some people. But when you really break down the job that we do, all of our staff, all of our program management staff that we have here at Ausmeat are all technical managers in things like food safety, animal welfare, carcass grading and eating quality, and in new fields, things like the ESG fields as well, corporate social responsibility for that matter as well. So they're all emerging challenges that our industry will face over the next couple of years. That's kind of where I've come through to be where I'm at today.
Sounds like you spend a lot of time in bureaucracy, Ben, in your travels.
probably a bit too much, Scott, but that's all stuff that you learn along the way. Try to, Ausmeat's really about trying to keep out of the politics in the working functions that we do. Our job's about maintaining industry integrity and all the things that underpin the claims, if you like, and the integrity and the reputation of Australian product on the global market. That's our charter. That's our job. So custodians of the standards.
I'm sure those early years in the plants gave you a good grounding and a good vocabulary to go forward with.
Absolutely, did. Plenty of early mornings and plenty of cold chillers. Absolutely.
It did. Looks great. Ben, we are mainly interested in where does Angus fit in. Can you talk about the Label and Standards Committee and how is that the framework then for establishing a labelling program that then is used, which eventually we'll get to the Angus part, but what does that committee do and what's the work that goes on behind the scenes generally?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So I suppose one of the key components of the Ausmeat National Accreditation Standards is that Ausmeat actually convene a committee called the Australian Meat Industry Language and Standards Committee. And that group's made up of all the industry peak councils. So, most of your listeners, again, will have heard of Cattle Australia, the Australian Lot Feeders Association, the Australian Meat Industry Council, Sheep Producers Australia, the Commonwealth Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry. They're the core groups. We've got supermarkets and retailers on there as well. So they're the core peak representative groups that sit on that committee. And that committee are the custodians of the standards. So, I always say, at Ausmeat here, the employees of Ausmeat, we're kind of driving the vehicle, but we certainly don't create the specifications for that vehicle. That's the Australian Meat Industry Language and Standards Committee. So that committee are responsible for all of the trade descriptions and how they're applied across the industry. And I suppose the key thing that drives decisions and standards and the work that we do is that in legislation, there's a very clear definition of what a trade description is, and that is that it must be accurate, number one, and it must be unambiguous to the consumer. So that's the lens that we run across every, if you like, standard that we develop. And so when you get down to the level then where you start to look at boxes of meat that are passing through processing facilities or export boning rooms, as it might be, the bulk of our work really starts with the carton and all of the descriptions on the carton, right? So if you like, the box itself and all the descriptions that are on it that describe anything about what is inside it, that is what we focus on. So then what we're responsible for doing is working our way back through the processing facility, back to the farm gate where necessary, to make sure that all of the claims that are on the box or on the label are true and correct, they're accurate and unambiguous, and that we can support that with good traceability programs and good quality management programs that underpin best practice, if you like, right? So when we get to that point where we start talking about how does Ausmeat you know, what relevance does Angus have? Well, we all know in the marketplace that that the Angus brand and the breed claims that are made around Angus by the time we get to a box of meat, there's more claims made on Angus programs than any other breed in this country, right? So Angus is just one claim. It's what we refer to as a breed claim. And we have to ensure that where they are applied to boxes of meat, that effectively those animals have come from a base standard, as we've got, that we'll talk about today. And we can validate and verify that the animal in the box is actually an Angus animal. So there's a whole bunch of other things on a label when you start looking at trade descriptions, and they're things like the product name itself. So if we've put a rump in a box, that there is actually a rump in a box. If it says beef on the box, then it is beef on the box. And you know, one of the key fundamental parts of Ausmeat when it was first created was off the back of a crisis issue they had in the late 70s, and that was that there was some Australian processors caught with boxes of beef in the US, but had actually put kangaroo in the box, right? And that caused what was called the old Woodward Royal Commission of the day, and that was the investigation into the substitution scandal at the time, right? So that's right back at the very foundation of really why Ausmeat was created, to make sure that what we put in the box and all the descriptions that align with it are true, accurate, and correct. And what does that do for us? That is what builds Australian product trust with all of our international partners. So in the work that we then do with the United Nations is all about, you know, weaving our trading language, if you like, through all the different standards around the globe, so that people understand Australian meat, they understand how we operate, how we describe it. And that then benefits our industry indirectly through reduced trade barriers. So Angus is one in the scheme of things. Mm. It's one trade description. It's a very important trade description. And as such, you know, when we think about the last 2.5 years and all the processes that we've been through to get to where we are here today, there's been a lot of passion. There've been a lot of really hard conversations. But what we've been able to do as an industry is come together and release this week what the future looks like as far as the types of brands that can be created around Angus claims.
Ben, you've got the box of meat from a processor on the pallet, your sticker on the end of the box with some claims. But for those who may not have seen that, what are some of the other claims that we've got an Angus claim, for example? What would some of the other claims be that would be also present on that label?
Yeah, so some of the other claims might be, I'm just thinking, so Ausmeat have what we call an animal raising claim framework, right? So that can be accessed actually by any producer in Australia should they choose to want to have a look at it. So it sits in the Ausmeat members section of our website, which is actually free to join. So any of your listeners can jump on that and have a look at any time. But the sorts of different claims that you'll find that support our product going into certain markets around the globe could be things like HTP-free. We know that's one of the strict criteria for all of our product entering the European Union. It could be claims like grain-fed. So we know in Australia here we have what's called the National Feedlot Accreditation Scheme, which is run by Ausmeat as well on behalf of industry. And that scheme allows us to be able to pack a product, meet a minimum standard for the grain-fed industry. And that then guarantees, again, a minimum set of criteria for grain-fed product where it's packed. So that's also underpinned by legislation. It could be something like grass-fed. So we know, you know, the explosion of be them certified or verified grass-fed programs over the course of the past 10 years. There could be things like organic. Again, there's a very specific organic standard both here in Australia, but even the United States organic program is a massive one for Australian exporters as well. So it's a very high value market into the US. Yeah, again, free range, antibiotic free. So there's a big long list of weird and wonderful claims that our industry can make that support the product and market access, and at the end of the day, drive additional value in our product. And we're responsible for making sure that all of those claims that are made accurate and unambiguous. That's it in a nutshell.
Excellent. So Ben, a couple of years ago, a discussion happened. We started to see a bit of media attention. There became quite a bit of interest in Angus beef labelling. Before we get into that, do you want to give us what was the the status quo, if we go back before these changes are implemented today, how was Angus beef identified from an export standpoint until recently?
That's a good starting point, Scott. You know, you can kind of trace the very origins of Angus claims back to about 2006, 2007, and a lot of that foundation was built on, if your listeners remember, I think it was about 2008 when McDonald's released the Big Angus burger, and at that point in time, really McDonald's through their quality programs drove the need to ensure that the meat that they were purchasing for that particular product was underpinned, it was true and correct. So what that meant at the time was that a foundation was developed, and there were already foundations there at the time, and be that the North American, specifications for what an Angus was, and that was very much subscribed to in the very early days. But industry had to do a fair bit of catching up, and part of that catching up was to develop really what an Angus was for the purposes of packing meat. So McDonald's drove a lot of that, and what happened there in 2008 was that, you know, and to this day, you know, manufactured product and trim accounts for almost 50% of the meat that we actually export around the globe. So it's huge, you know. So when you think about the amount of trim that we send to the US, it was a massive market for Australian Angus branded products to go into burgers, whether that was to go to the US or to be maintained here in Australia. So that was a market that was very valuable, and it still is to this day. And but what had to underpin that was the integrity of the claim. So what we've had since then, I suppose the challenge that we've had along the way is that Australia, for better or for worse, set a minimum standard of 70% genetic criteria for Angus animals to be deemed an Angus animal to be packed into a box. That when you look around the globe at the other countries that had criteria for Angus, most of them were set at actually 50%, Scott, and the majority of them still sit at that today. So Australia set the bar high, and they did that with good reason. And there's plenty of good work that's gone into that, into the development of the Angus brand, and we hang our hat on that on the international market. So that's the origins of Angus claims here in Australia. And that's how it's operated right the way through till this week, where the minimum genetic criteria was always 75%, but there was also some pretty strict phenotypic criteria that were applied to animals as well to support that.
Do you think, Ben, that 50% requirement internationally, largely our listeners are quite familiar with the CAB program in the US, do you think that stemmed from, in the early days, did that stem from that CAB program? Is that, yeah, that 50%? Yeah.
Yeah, look, absolutely it did. And that's always been the expectation of the US in any product that we export, right? So that created a challenge for our industry and it had been talked about on and off for a lot of years. You know, you could actually export product from Australia even now before the change that was 50% Angus, but it had to go to the US market, right? So if that product didn't land in the US though, and it was kept back in here in Australia, then it meant those processing facilities that were doing that were having to relabel their product. So it was causing a hell of a lot of challenges at processing facilities with relabeling where product didn't actually get to the US. So that was a big challenge. And that's part of, I suppose, with the new requirement, the new standard that's come in, that'll ease the challenges for the processing industry, certainly in that space.
Okay. Now, Ben, there was a conversation started. Obviously, the Label and Standards Committee, you've got different people. It'd be probably like trying to wrangle cats, I imagine, at some point there. You've got different competing interests from different types of industry bodies there. What was the impetus? So we had, previously, you have 75% Angus product and 100%. What was the impetus and what was required by some of those players to go to a 50% product in general terms, Ben? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what's important to understand in all of this is that the foundation, and about 2.5 years ago, we were approached, and the approach initially was, hey, we want to pack a 50% Angus product and we want to call it Angus, right? So that was the initial approach by industry. And as we would, when we cast our lens over it, we actually rejected that because it was new ground for us, you know. So the term Angus associated with Angus animals with 50% genetics initially didn't kind of pass the pump test. So we had a lot of conversations about that over the space of about 6 months. That sort of instigated a deeper dive into, you know, what it meant from a trade descriptive perspective, both here on the domestic market, should products stay here, and then a scan across all of our export partners as well and what they deemed as acceptable, right? So what we found was when we looked at all of the export market, they all had a minimum criteria of 50% through our major trading partners. So when we started to have a look at the domestic market, it was a different story again. It was all about maintaining the high standard and the high bar that we'd already created for ourselves, all right? So that was how it all started. And look, here we are 2.5 years later. And like I said, very early on, there's been a lot of challenges through this. There's been a lot of robust conversation, but what we were able to do in the end was come together and find the mid ground. And the mid ground meant that both the production sector were happy through Cattle Australia and the Australian Lot Feeders Association, and that the processing sector, who they're represented by the Australian Meat Industry Council, they were happy with the outcome that we'd achieved. So look, we didn't really have to, there wasn't any sort of challenges that we weren't able to meet along the way. It was about finding the balance in between all of that. And that was what we arrived at on Wednesday this week.
Again, do you want to just give us an overview now of where have we arrived as an industry? And I think quite honestly, there's some confusion by producers and maybe the consumer as well. So where have we arrived at? Ben, do you want to give us the snapshot of what those new descriptors are now?
Yeah, so, hey, look, what we can say is that the status quo remains for those animals that were packed or that were bred for the traditional Angus box, right? So that's the minimum criteria of 75% genetics. What we've done is we've now added a 50% option there should a processor choose to use that and brand his products appropriately. So the key fundamental, I suppose, right through the development of this has been, it's been about the integrity of the Angus breed and the Angus brand, right? So keep that very separate from the conversation of quality, if that makes a little bit of sense. So really all we've done is introduce the ability to take now a 50% Angus animal and label that as either Angus 50 or Angus F1. And there is a third trade description called Angus Composite, right? So you can use one of those three descriptions should you choose to pack and brand and market an Angus animal from a 50% genetic animal, if you like.
And then, Ben, we've kept Angus 75. And what are the descriptors now that we can use for a 75% product?
Yeah, and it's a good point, Scott. So what we've also been able to do through this is to set in stone, if you like, the trade description. So what are the terms you can use on a label for the different groups, right? So off the back of saying what the 50 ones were, there are three different descriptors for a 75% animal. So that is an Angus 75, an Angus F2, or you can actually just use the word Angus. And that is traditionally how it's been since 2008. Then when you get through and you have a look at the animals that are 100% genetic Angus animals, they can either be called Angus, they can be called pure Angus, or they can be called Angus 100s. And Black Angus, I think, is the
Black
other
Angus.
One. Yeah, Black Angus is the other one.
No, that's great. Now, a question that I'll get asked is, I'm a Red Angus producer. I want to produce a Red Angus to go in a box. How do they fit in, Ben?
Yeah, no, good question. And hey, guess what? We crossed that bridge a number of times over the last couple of years. Look, the decision's been made at this point in time to focus on Black Angus. So it was really about getting the black breed out of the road first. What I can actually say to you is we have developed the initial foundations of a Red Angus framework as well. And we'll actually be kicking off, I quite expect, at our next meeting where we'll actually table that document. So we're still yet to kind of collaborate with the Red Angus Society. But what we need to work through now is what the phenotypic criteria is and what's acceptable to both industry and the society itself. So what I can say to you at this point in time, though, is, you know, and a lot of this is driven by demand too, Scott. So at this point in time, there are not any Red Angus marketed products going out of Australian processing facilities. That doesn't mean there won't be in the future, but it's kind of on the back burner a little bit at this point in time. But we will continue to progress that, as we will with all of the other breed claims as well, because it's not just Angus. Don't forget, we've got frameworks for Wagyu. There's a framework for Hereford. There's actually a framework for Shorthorn, and there's also a framework for Santa Gertrudis, funnily enough.
Interesting. Glad to hear that. Now, a question listeners will want to know, how is that determined? So we've got a phenotypic description. So how does a process of a group of animals or oil field processing plant, how do they determine whether they're Angus or not, Ben?
Yeah, good question. So I'll start with the 50 program, right? So one of the set criteria for this new claim, for the Angus 50 claim, is that there's two pathways, all right? And pathway number one is that the animals meet a certain phenotypic criteria. And what I can say is that criteria in meeting the minimum requirements of the US, all right, is exactly the same, all right? So the criteria for that is that the animal must present Angus characteristics. Its main body must be solid black, and it's not to have any other colour behind the shoulder, above the flanks, or breaking the midline behind the shoulder. And it says here, excluding the tail, right? So that's the phenotypic criteria for what would be deemed a 50% genetically made up Angus animal. So when you look at the detail of that, it's probably far up. Yeah, there's plenty of Angus animals that will meet that, but I would also preempt that there's a lot of 50% Angus animals that wouldn't meet that, right? So what we've actually done in recognising that is build a second pathway. So should the animals not meet the phenotypic criteria, and as far as we're concerned, they could be pink with purple polka dots, but if they are 50% genetically contained Angus animals, then there is a pathway where a processor can source those animals through an accredited on-farm program that actually traces the genetic heritage of that line of cattle. All right, so that is the second option, and that option actually takes away any need to look at the phenotypic traits of that animal when it comes in. So it's purely going to be based on a quality program that a processor manages, that sources those animals and demonstrates traceability right back through to the breeder of those animals. So there's a lot of flexibility built into that. And keep in mind, there are, you know, when you look across the different processing companies in Australia at the moment, a lot of those processing companies already have on-farm quality assurance programs, and they have those because they've got existing claims, things like grass-fed, things like antibiotic-free. So a lot of producers are being accessed by the large processors for quality programs now. So it's really as simple as adding some criteria in there around Angus and actually assessing that on-farm and ensuring the traceability and integrity of the product. So, yeah, I think if that answers your question, then I think the next bit is, if the animals come to the processing plant and they need to be phenotypically assessed, then that's done by both the livestock staff at the processing facilities and more often than not, they're being overseen by the Department of Agriculture staff as well, who are representative at every export facility in Australia.
And we all have to fill out NVDs when we're selling cattle. Mm. How do those NVDs work into these programs?
Yeah, and look, that's critical, and this change really highlights it now, Scott. So in the past, probably what we've done is a lot of the time we've just written Angus on our NVDs, right? And what that's meant is that the animals are 75 or better and we can put them into that box. By now bringing in an Angus 50 claim, we need to be able to separate that on NVDs, right? So really, if I'm providing any sort of advice for producers at this point in time, you need to be able to segregate it, and you can quite simply do that by writing Angus 50. It would be quite acceptable to put Angus F1 on an NVD as well, anything that really determines that animal is 50% Angus genetic. So you could still put, you know, if you put your description on there and it said Angus cross Hereford, absolutely, that's going to be accepted as well. So, but everything above that and beyond that, you can still continue just to use the Angus term where it's 75% or better.
No, that's a good question we'll have, Ben. Big growth of Angus into Queensland and the Northern Territory. That's been an important market for us. So you're a central Queensland producer. You've got your Bos Indicus herd, whether that be a Brahman herd or a Santa Gertrudis herd, your drought master there. You've done the right thing. You've bought a registered Angus bull. You've put over your Bos Indicus herd. And you arrive at the, you fatten those steers, they go to the processing plant, but they've got a bit of ear and they've got a bit of hump. And how does that fit in, Ben, to a 50% program? Will they be, Is the program just related to the Angus content, or does it take into account other factors?
Nah, great question. And look, the Angus 50 content, if that's what we're talking about here, is the additional cross other than the Angus can be from any other breed of cattle. All right. So I go back to a point I made earlier on. You know, our aim here is about the integrity of the Angus breed, right? Quality components of animals is a very different conversation. So the quality of the animals and the product at the end of the day is driven by the processing companies, right? Processing companies develop specifications for livestock, producers see that in their pricing grids, all right? And that's what gives them the target to aim at when they're producing animals. That tells them where they need to be to earn the most amount of money for their animals, right? So that really comes down, you know, that's the commercial aspect and the difference between brands, if you like. And I suppose, and as somebody that's been around eating quality for now over 25 years, you know, and we've always said there's a lot of variation, there's actually more variation within breeds of cattle in eating quality than there is across breeds of cattle, all right? So what you tend to find, and as someone that works in processing very heavily now, what you see is where you've got very high-end, you know, Angus-claimed product, you'll see some very strict eating quality criteria, and that's what helps to ensure that the customer gets the experience they're looking for at the other end.
Excellent. No, so really, I guess the clarity for our members listening to this is this program relates to the Angus component, not the other component that might be in that animal.
100%. This is about Angus and what is and what isn't. And you know, and your price at the farm gate will be determined by the number one, the processor you're supplying your product into, and the specifications that they're imposing on you, so that they can achieve the best outcome from their grading and from an eating quality perspective as they can.
Excellent. No, that's fantastic. Now, Ben, at this point in time, we don't, in the processing sector, we don't have verification by DNA, but as you know, we've been discussing with you for a while, we've been working very heavily on a breed content test by DNA. We've got a couple of processes about to launch with that, which is a fantastic innovation for the breed. And we'll have some later this year, we'll put some publicity out around that as that program starts to take off. Can you see a day, Ben, where we'll move from phenotypes to a more objective measurement? Do you think that if you go medium term down the track, can you see an appetite in the sector for that?
That's the ultimate, Scott, isn't it? You know, if we can get away from having subjective conversations about phenotype in the yards, that's utopia. All right. So like what I can say to you is we did actually investigate the option of maybe having some DNA requirement attached to this. And we looked at that very early on. What we kind of, I suppose, got out of that at the time was that from a commercial perspective and given the technology and where it sits at today, that it just wasn't going to suit this program, particularly given the delays around, you know, the date of sample and the result collection on that. Our industry was concerned at the time about the sort of cost that was going to be imposed on that as well. But I certainly know some of the work that you guys are working through. And for me, I'm going to say the mid to long term is that actually we do have DNA sampling. We have a sort of rapid testing program where we can deliver it cost effectively. We can get the results rapidly, and then that's going to solve a hell of a lot of problems.
No, thanks, Ben. Yeah, in relation to these three different tiers of programs, where can, if members are interested in finding out a little bit more, where should they be heading to? Ben, by the time this goes to air, we've sent some information to our members from provided by Ausmeat, so they can have a look at that. Where can they also be going, Ben, to find out more?
Yeah, look, Scott, you can jump onto our website. We think your members will have received probably our fairly simple fact sheet, which was a high-level overview of what the changes meant for industry. If you want to get in and have a look at the detail, you can certainly sign up to the members section of our website. I can say to you that's completely free. All you got to do is put your email address in and create yourself a password. And once you get in there, there's a whole section that deals with animal raising claims, all right? And in that particular section of the website, you will find the Angus breed claim criteria framework in there. And that steps out literally everything that we've spoken about today, what the program requirements are, what we would expect as far as descriptions on NVDs and what the phenotypic criteria is for each of the different groups. And you'll be able to find that for all breeds on our website.
Excellent. No, thanks, Ben. Is there anything else you think generally about this program that we've missed, Ben, that you think members should know about?
Oh, look, I think, there's a lot of good to come of this, Scott. You know, I've sat here for 2.5 years and listened to both sides of the story. But look, I think what this is going to provide is another opportunity for those breeders of the F1 type animals that exist out there. And, we can continue to let the 75s and 100s do their thing with very little impact. And some have said that, you know, it may create a divide and it may actually create more value for those higher content animals. But what it's doing is it's creating a market that doesn't exist now. And there's got to be benefits for that. There's certainly benefits for that and those animals for product being packed and sent off to the US. So I think, look, the mid to long term deal for this looks, and the outlook for this looks really good for the Australian Production Centre and those Angus breeders. It'll be interesting to see what it does in the short term, but I think heads up, I think we'll be a long way ahead once we can get this embedded in industry, and it won't take long. I can say to you, the day it was released, we received our first quality management system program from a processing facility looking to seek approval. So, and here we are 2 days later, and I can say to you, we've got another handful of them sitting on our table. So, so plants are moving, processing companies are moving very fast on this. And we'll be hoping to get that out there. I think we'll actually start auditing the program come the 1st of July. So we'll give the processing industry 3 months to embed all of the requirements into their programs. We'll approve the programs. And then come July 1 this year, we'll get out there and start having a good look at it and making sure that we're doing what we say we do.
And to be clear, Ben, it's an Australian export labeling, so it's not specific to a market, is it? This will apply to all export markets.
Yes, it will. Yeah, no, it's one rule, Scott. You know, if you're an AusMed accredited site, whether you're a domestic or an export accredited site, you've got to meet all of the same rules, and there is one set of labeling rules, if you like. And look, the very simple world, it's every description that goes onto a box of meat, as long as it's accurate and unambiguous, then AusMed will kind of leave you alone. And, we run audit programs with processing facilities. You know, they'll see us, you know, in some cases every month for the guys that are doing a good job, and they can prove that they're doing a good job. They'll see us a minimum of 4 times a year. And at each of those visits that we go to, we're looking at all of the trade descriptions that they use on boxes of meat to ensure that they're upholding the standards that we expect of them.
Excellent. Ben, I'll often get this question. So this relates to the meat is put in a box, very little control over what happens on a domestic retail shelf or a restaurant menu. That is completely reliant on the retail sector to take care of that. This just for clarity, this doesn't apply to a retail sector, does it?
Correct. Look, and I go back to what I kind of just said. If you're an AusMed accredited site, you've got to meet the one standard that they've all got to meet. But the state food authorities are the ones that regulate the use of the descriptions in both the retail and the food service industry here in Australia. And so, look, if people are caught doing the wrong thing, then the state food authorities will be on your door and want to know what's going on. So, AusMeat's charter finishes once that product leaves the processing facility, if you like. Then certainly when you go in country, into our export markets. Obviously, you know, AusMeat doesn't have a lot of control over that. You rely on the relationship you build in the supply chain to ensure the integrity of your product's maintained.
No, thanks, Ben. Just good to get clarity off when people will ask that question. So it's good for producers to realise. I would make a comment to the membership too. AusMeat have done an excellent job at the industry consultation during this process. And while not everyone might agree with the outcome, I think they've done a very good job at consulting industry, and I commend you for that, Ben. With regards to some of the other aspects of the industry we're involved with, consultation doesn't always mean consultation, but I would say that you have done a very good job at trying to work with what must be a very complex and challenging space at times to get agreement across. So I think you should be commended as an organisation for doing that.
No, thanks, Scott. And look, that's our job, right? We're here for industry, working for industry. So if we're not collaborating with industry, then we're not doing our job at the end of the day. So, you know, and I said to you early on, you know, you guys, there's a lot of people that had a lot of input into this, and everybody's input was valuable. So even right down to your board members and the feedback that we sought at different time throughout it. So so again, we appreciate the work from your guys' end as well.
Thanks, Ben. We probably got to the end of the Angus labelling, but if I can ask you just a couple of questions there to finish off, Ben. One I've got there is how does a kid from Gloucester get on a United Nations senior role? Did you tick the wrong box on a form, or
what? I've often wondered that myself. I again, as somebody that can be very technically minded, and I was fortunate enough to work under the guide of our former CEO and long term representative for the meat industry, Ian King, for a long period of time. And Ian King was very passionate about Australian product on the global market and making sure that, you know, we made Australian processing industry's life easier to enter certain markets around the globe. And and somewhere along the way, I really took a shine to that, and have a real passion for really trying to get more people around the globe to eat red meat. It's as simple as that, Scott. That's our job. We've got forces that try to stop us all the time, and you know, we don't need to talk about that today. But why I see my job is trying to get more people around the globe to eat red meat, and if we can make Australia's job of accessing markets a little bit easier, you know, that's my job at the end of the day, and I'll do whatever we need to facilitate that process. So, you know, being the chair at the UN involves a hell of a lot of work, and it takes a hell of a lot of hours outside of my normal day job. And my wife bashes me from ear to ear all the time with meetings that I might be attending at 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. But we also lucky enough to get over to the UN in Switzerland once every couple of years to keep that committee alive and keep it going in the best interests of trying to get more people eating red meat.
That's fantastic, Ben. So I commend you for that, and I think it's great, and I think all of us in the cattle industry are very thankful there's people plugging away behind the scenes to make sure we've got market access. As we learned in the last few years, market access is terribly important to the profitability of every producer in the country. So, no, thank you for that. And Ben, you're general manager, busy role. How do you keep yourself sharp? Are you a reader? What sorts of resources do you plug into?
How do I keep myself sharp, Scott? I got two teenagers and a tent and a whole bunch of push bikes, and so that tends to keep most of my weekends pretty occupied at the moment. I also love a game of golf. I also enjoy cooking on the barbecue. You'll find me at least once a month out on the smoker cooking a brisket or some steak. So, you know, it just goes with the job. I get very passionate about it, and it's like meat industry and livestock people. When you get together, there's not much else you really need to talk about. So, again, much to the disgust of my wife, by the way. But look, I suppose when I look across at all the things I do, you know, the meat industry, the livestock industry is intertwined in things that you do either within work or outside of work as well. So it's a fantastic industry to be a part of, that's for sure.
That's great. Our producer, Mel Strasburg, who's on the call with us, he keeps himself sharp with two teenagers as well, Ben, so I'm sure we've got something in common there. Ben, you're a bit of an amateur smoker like myself. We both enjoy that. We've talked about that before. What would be your best beef eating experience that you've ever had?
I'm glad you asked me this at the start, right? Because I actually didn't have to think about it very long, Scott. I can actually say to you the best piece of meat that I've ever put into my mouth was an Angus branded product. I'm not sure I should give away the brand, but it was actually, I brought six cartons of strip loins back in 2010 for my wedding, and they were actually Angus branded products with a marble score of 3+. So they were strip loins with a marble score of 3+. And I'm still pretty confident to this day that that's the best piece of meat that I've ever eaten. So, and from, I think, Black Angus branded products. So they would have been 100%.
Wow, that's fantastic. I think of all the people we've talked to on this podcast, you just went to the top of the list in terms of you got the brand right with Angus. But
I'm not just saying that. I have very fond memories, as do a lot of my family, of that meat from that day. And I still get to this day family members that say to me, you know, and here I am 16 years later saying that, hey, that meat that we had at your wedding was still the best meat I've eaten.
That's fantastic. That's great. And you're still happily married, so it must have been
absolutely done a good job for you. And I think at the time it was only $13 a kilo too, Scott, so the same product today is probably in excess of $40.
Yeah, costs you a bit more today. That's absolutely right. That's right. Look, Ben, it's been a real pleasure to get to know you over the last few years, and And we certainly appreciate you taking some time out today. We thank you for your work you do behind the scenes. Thank you for being able to draw this to a conclusion. And yeah, we hope it's a good success for our processes that support Angus product. So yeah, just like to thank you for joining us on the Angus table today, Ben.
No, thanks, Scott. Appreciate your time. And look, again, thanks for all of your effort behind the scenes, and thanks for your support as we've moved through the challenges of the last couple of years.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.